The presenting sponsor of Food Safety Matters is Eurofins. A thorough environmental monitoring program is vital for both food safety and risk mitigation. Eurofins offers training courses on both environmental monitoring and other common food safety topics, such as HACCP, SQF, and FSMA. Learn more about how Eurofins can help you with your EMP at eurofins.us/EMP. That's Eurofins, eurofins.us/EMP. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director, and Tiffany Mayberry, digital editor of the magazine. Today's episode will feature Barbara's interview with John Butts, vice president of research at Lando Frost. We are very pleased to have John join us on the podcast today. He's widely known for the development of the seek and destroy process controls for Listeria, which have been adopted throughout the food industry. He's a leading expert on sanitary design and food safety culture and has given, oh my goodness, over 100 presentations, not including AMI Listeria Intervention and Controls workshops. I don't even know how many it gets to be after that. So way to go, John. We are very proud to say that he's a longtime member of the Food Safety Magazine Editorial Advisory Board and has written numerous articles for the magazine. So I guess you can understand why we're so pleased to have John join us and to share him with our podcast audience. We've been working on getting John here for a while, so yay! Before we hear that excellent interview, we're going to take a look at a few news stories that have caught our attention since the last episode. Tiffany?
So first, we're starting off with some news from Walmart. Walmart has announced a new food traceability initiative, which is specifically geared towards their leafy green suppliers. The retailer cites the recent romaine lettuce outbreak as an impetus for starting this new program. Walmart says that even though FDA and CDC were able to inform consumers, producers, and retailers that the contaminated lettuce originated in the Yuma, Arizona growing region, no one involved in the investigation was able to quickly determine which lots were affected and which were not. This resulted in millions of bags and heads of lettuce that had to be removed from the marketplace, also causing a significant loss in consumer confidence because people had no way to determine if their lettuce was from the affected region or not. Walmart believes that by working together with supply chain partners, their blockchain initiative will be beneficial in multiple ways. First, they'll have the ability to quickly trace leafy greens back to their original source during an outbreak, and in turn, this will positively impact human health. In addition, health officials can conduct rapid and more thorough root cause analysis to inform future prevention efforts. And finally, using blockchain will minimize financial impact by not having to destroy unaffected food products that are not linked to an outbreak. In beta testing, Walmart's food traceability initiative has shown that it can reduce the amount of time that it takes to track a food item from a Walmart store back to its original source in just seconds. Traditionally, this process can take days or even weeks. Walmart's program will require its leafy green suppliers to capture digital end-to-end traceability events using the IBM Food Trust blockchain network.
I'm guessing that if they see some success with the leafy green suppliers, that they will roll this out for other food commodities that they get in their stores. So maybe we can hear back from Frank about that down the road.
Maybe. But this is the first time we've heard that it's, quote, required. That they've publicly stated that it's required.
Because Walmart suppliers may have to also coordinate with their own suppliers, all parties are expected to have blockchain traceability in place by the end of September 2019.
Which made us just go, September 2019. But then in further digging, which seemed fast, but not as fast as what we then found out, which is that actually if you're a direct supplier, isn't that? That was the caveat there. If you're right. A direct supplier, then you have to be in compliance by January
which is like 2019. Tomorrow, so.
So Yeah, isn't that tomorrow? My goodness. So we're wondering, you know, of course, maybe there's been some communication internally from Walmart with those direct suppliers already, but man, oh man. So I guess here's a little inside baseball here for us at Food Safety Magazine. But for those who know Food Safety Magazine well, you know Bobby Meeker. She's like, you know, when you think of Food Safety Magazine, you think of Red. You think of Bobby Meeker, who also happens to be my mother, who also happens to be 82 years old. So go, Bob. She's still going. So the other day, before she picks up the phone, she calls me and she's like, Stacey, I just saw this article in the New York Times, and not the New York Times, the LA Times, about Walmart and the leafy greens. She goes, can you explain blockchain to me? I don't think that I understand it. And I said, well, you're in very good company, Bobby. A lot of people are trying to get their head around what blockchain is. So in an effort to, I thought, well, how am I going to explain this to her? So I quickly, you know, Google machine, and I found an infographic by Reuters that is actually pretty amazing. And we all agree that that's just an excellent reference. So we're going to include a link to that in the show notes. That should help people. We also, if you have other questions, would direct you to, we did on June 28th, we dropped a bonus episode called Blockchain Facts, Fiction, and Future. And of course, our interview with Frank Yiannis, the man himself from Walmart. Oh, I don't remember that. What was the episode?
That was episode 32.
Okay. Thanks, Tiffany. Maybe we'll put a link for that episode as well. So here we go. Blockchain. Looks like it's coming.
It's coming.
It's coming. All right, Tiffany, what's next?
Okay, so moving on. FDA has issued some new draft guidance to help determine when it is necessary to publicly disclose retailers that are on the receiving end of recalled food products. Currently, stores that have recalled food products tend to not be publicized for two reasons. First, certain supply chain details are confidential and kept between the supplier and the retailer. Also, it's been historically believed that the information that is given to the public is already sufficient enough to help them determine whether or not they are in possession of a recalled food item. Now, FDA's draft guidance, if adopted, could allow consumers to quickly and accurately recognize recall products and take action to either avoid it or seek assistance if they've already been exposed to it. The guidance is also meant to improve the efficiency of recalls by helping the public to only focus on items that are a part of the recall and not focusing on unaffected, even if similar, items. FDA is currently accepting comments and suggestions regarding this draft guidance, and we'll be sure to put a link on the website for anyone who wants to share their comments with FDA.
I mean, I realize the logistical nightmare that FDA would have if they wanted to do this for all of the products that they oversee, but I think more information is better than not enough information. And consumers often need a lot of help trying to figure out if what they've purchased is part of the recall, and there's some recall fatigue. So,
yeah, I guess I want to clarify too that comment period is 60 days from when they announced the guidance. So for people who want to comment, that's a 60-day period. So you might want to get on that. But our discussion internally here did sort of focus around that it isn't for all, that, you know, that it's when food product in question is not easily identified or doesn't have any packaging at all. You know, buys packaging or doesn't. So we'll see. We'll see what comes out of this on the other end of that comment period. So.
All right. And our last story today focuses on the recent ground beef outbreak and recall. So Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro is demanding answers from the USDA after a deadly E. coli outbreak took over a month to trigger a ground beef recall. USDA FSIS was first notified about a cluster of E. coli illnesses on August 16th, but it wasn't until August 30th, 2 weeks later, that raw ground beef products sold by public supermarkets was recalled. Then it took another 20 days for 66 tons of ground beef products made by Cargill to be recalled on September 19th. So from USDA's initial notification of illnesses to the Cargill recall was a 35-day lapse. After pointing out these facts, DeLauro's letter, which is addressed to Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, goes on to ask a list of questions about how this outbreak and recall was handled and timelines for when the USDA actually found out what was going on. To date, no response from USDA has been made public.
Now, we've talked a lot about supply chain, and one question I have is, okay, Cargill is in Minnesota, Publix is in the Southeast. Are there other supermarket chains affected? And, you know, knowing one step back and one step forward, we have a lot of questions about.
We have a lot of questions. Dare we even admit we have a lot of questions about this? We weren't sure blockchain could, you know, seems to be the topic as well. So, well, this also got us, once we quickly moved past, gosh, we have a lot of questions we don't have answers to. So we're not going to go in depth on all of that. But that, you know, Rosa DeLauro seems to be very active in food stuff. And we were sort of like, well, why is that? And so we did a little bit of digging around and realized that she is on, and she is the chair of the House Food Safety Caucus. And then realized that, you know, caucuses are different than committees. So that explained why, as a Democrat, she's chair, because it's a volunteer club. But the other point that we kind of noticed was that there are, what was it, Barbara, were there 9 or 10 members of
ten,
the caucus?
10 members.
Ten members of the caucus, all 10 of which are Democrats. Now, we don't get political here. We have no interest in being political here. But it is worth noting that if, as a food safety professional, you happen to be represented by a Republican, you might want to mention to them that maybe they should check out in the House, that they should maybe check out joining the Food Safety Caucus, that would be an important thing to have voice in. So let's get as many voices in there and get as much activity as possible. So, you know, call your reps.
But I think we should also give a shout out to this lovely congresswoman from Connecticut for all of her good work for food safety.
She has been very active, and we used to do some when we had our organic processing magazine. We used to do what do you call them, lobby days, and go up there and talk to Congress, which was when I discovered that we actually have an open government. You can actually go talk to your senators and representatives. It's amazing. So
maybe I will reach out to her to see if she might like to be a special guest on our podcast.
Yeah, that could happen. You know, maybe, all right. Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Representative DeLauro, you're
down
on notice. But let's get some Republicans on that committee. Come on, you guys. Come out to play. Let's do it. All right. What else, Tiffany?
Well, with all that said, you can keep up with industry news and all of Food Safety Magazine's content by visiting our website, foodsafetymagazine.com. And you can become one of our followers on both Twitter and LinkedIn. Just search Food Safety Magazine.
All right, next is Barbara's interview with John Butts, Vice President of Research at Lando Frost, where he's worked since 1974. John's focus includes the application of scientific principles and quality management technology to develop sanitation process control methods and procedures. Throughout his career at Lando Frost, Dr. Butts has led the company and the meat industry in food safety efforts. He chartered the company team that developed the seek and destroy concept for investigating sanitation and sanitary design problems, which has been adopted industry-wide. In 2010, he founded and serves as president of Food Safety by Design, a private consulting firm that aims to help producers of high-risk products learn how to prevent and manage food safety risks. John received the Food Safety Magazine Distinguished Service Award in 2006, and as I mentioned before, and of course most importantly, John is a longtime member of the Food Safety Magazine Editorial Advisory Board.
You know, back when we launched one of the features in the magazine, the spotlight on meat and poultry, John was instrumental in helping me develop that.
Oh, yeah.
And identify some great contributors, himself included. So, It was great to talk to John and pick his brain about the really important topic of Listeria control and the work that he did with the seek and destroy method. So
yeah, it's a great interview.
It's a great.
Yeah. All right. So then after a quick break, we're going to hear that interview. Are you in need of a third-party testing laboratory that offers EMP services? Eurofins can be your food safety partner in creating an environmental monitoring program as an innovative way to mitigate risks in your facility and meet requirements set by GFSI schemes. In addition to assisting you with developing your program, Eurofins offers EMP training courses that cover how to design, monitor, and maintain your EMP. Learn more at eurofins.us/EMP. That's Eurofins, eurofins.us/EMP.
Hi, John. It's my pleasure to welcome you to our podcast today. You've been an active member of our editorial advisory board for many years, and I've really been looking forward to having this in-depth conversation about Listeria process control with you. You've spoken and written extensively on this topic, which is always very popular at the food safety meetings that I've attended. So let's get started. So some of the research that I did prior to our recording today, meat has not been directly linked to an illness or fatality due to Listeria since around 2003. What has the meat industry done to achieve this outcome, particularly in cooked ready-to-eat products?
Well, thank you, Barbara. That's a great point, and it's an honor to be able to do this with you. And it likewise an honor to be part of the processed meat industry that really got actively involved in Listeria control, actually, you know, in the late 80s, and went through the 90s. Then in the 90s, our day of reckoning, in fact, 98, 99, we had many outbreaks, illnesses, and unfortunately fatalities. So we're really farther along from the process control standpoint than the folks who are in the FDA regulated facilities. The key things that we did in as an industry centered around education, and education in both educating our peers, education in understanding sanitary design of both equipment and facilities. One of the keys to all of this occurring was the AMI Board of Directors voted to make food safety non-competitive. And that was very significant. And I think significance remains today, because we're still just starting to see many of the other allied food industries take this seriously in a non-competitive fashion. So one of the things we learned through our development of best practices was we had to sample to find it. And we had to redesign or apply interventions to eliminate it. This led us to develop methods that minimized movement. And that's really one of the keys, is understanding how this organism moves around. We evolved hygienic zoning. You know, hygienic zoning, you know, in some cases people think of as yellow lines.
Right.
Well, let me explain yellow lines. Yellow lines in a plant are just like a yellow light in Chicago. That organism is going to get through that just as fast as he can. It simply doesn't work. We need physical barriers. The other thing we learned was sanitizers on floors. Again, these developments came out of meetings such as what Bruce Tompkin was holding in the late 90s. And we also learned that dry floors were critical to control. You know, the list goes on and on. And we developed educated best practices and to our industry, and frankly anybody that wanted to attend. We were also helped along, frankly, by the USDA regulatory efforts. They've always encouraged aggressive sampling, along with contact surface verification of process controls. So I think it was a combination of things. One, our leaders recognizing the importance of food safety, sharing of best practices, combined with a regulatory effort that promoted that. And they have their own verification system, which we still get sampled every month. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a full collaborative whole team effort to get to this point. What is it about Listeria that makes it so problematic? We learned a lot more about Listeria in South Africa and that the incubation time is so long. But what are other points about Listeria that make it so much of a challenge?
Well, very simply, our plants provide the perfect environment for Listeria harborage and growth. The adaptation to that moist, cool atmosphere in the protected areas is very easy for the organism. That's why we must have procedures that challenge their ability to reproduce. Again, Listeria loves that wet or moist environment, but it can survive in a dry environment. But in general, its movement is limited compared to a wet environment. So, you know, our environment's perfect for its growth, and it's adapted quite successfully.
So chalk one up for evolution for Listeria, I guess. I'd like to focus on a method that you developed and that your company, Land of Frost, has been using since the early 90s to manage the processing plant environment to eliminate the root cause of product contamination by Listeria. And so that method is seek and destroy. Can you take us through the steps of this process and how you've used it as a process validation tool?
Well, you know, I was hired by Paul Van Eckeren, the owner of Land of Frost. He was an engineer, and part of his love of our business was to design and build equipment and, you know, re-engineer things. We actually sold packaging machines in the late 80s. So it was common for us to refurbish equipment. When I joined in 1974, we had the person who had the original patent on a Burkle slicing machine. And we've been redesigning those machines ever since. But put simply, because of that, we learned sanitary equipment design the hard way. We've had some tough days with that. So Paul taught us to critically think and to get to the root of the problem. And that's what our S&D team did in Searcy, Arkansas, in 1992 on our slicers. The process starts out by observing the normal cleaning and sanitation process. You observe the application of sanitizer, whether it's flood or foam, and you're making sure that all parts and compounds are being adequately sanitized, or components, that all parts and components are being adequately sanitized with chemical or heat. We observe assembly. Then we observe post-assembly sanitizer application. Again, making sure that everything's being adequately covered. Then we observe normal setup and startup activities. Are the GMPs being followed? After that, we will stop the operation just before product is placed on the line. Then we will start the disassembly process to the normal daily level. As we do that, we inspect and swab any suspect areas. We're looking for evidence of unacceptable organic buildup. If we find that, then the prior degree of disassembly was not acceptable, or the prior cleaning methods were not acceptable. We're also looking for both pathogens and non-pathogens. So we're analyzing for both Listeria and APC. So we continue then the disassembly process. Once we've stopped at the normal daily level, we then take everything apart. And this is the challenging part for all of us in the pathogen control business in food safety, because we really have to take it apart. Mm-hmm. And that's where the rubber really meets the road. Once we've got the equipment disassembled, we clean and heat or flood sanitize all the components. We put stuff in a COP tank. We heat things. So that way we know when this process is completed whether or not we did encounter a pathogen, or if we have growth niches that are below the normal daily level of disassembly. So that's the S&D mission or investigation. We now recognize that S&D is not only an investigation tool, but a process to eliminate and manage the environment in a food processing plant. It has taken on a much broader scope. The process can be preventive and predictive. And to that point, I want to credit two individuals, Steve Jones and Michael Womack, in our Searcy plant, who have played a major role in the evolution of the mission to pathogen control process. They've been hands-on for over 25 years, and we have to give them a lot of credit for sustaining the process from a mission to a process.
You know, for companies that either haven't applied this method or are interested in doing so, can you provide some real-life examples that a company is likely to encounter and how this process, this seek and destroy process, would help effectively investigate a positive result and allow additional interventions to be carried out?
Well, that regardless of how the product is contaminated, we have to look at three factors, and we use them to define the difference between the sites that we're sampling. We have transfer points, vectors, and harborage site. And our sampling and investigation process needs to be focused to define those three components of a potential of a contamination situation. Harborage sites must be eliminated or managed. We will never eliminate transfer points or vectors, but harborage sites, that's the root cause, or as Sean Stevens likes to say, the root source. Uh-huh. I know Sean's going to do one of these, so listen to Sean. Here's what you don't do. You don't ignore it and see if it happens again. You don't vigorously clean and sanitize the surface in question, then sample that surface for 3 days in a row to get three negatives in a row. You don't vigorously clean and sanitize the surface, then sample, then walk around in circles to try to find a harborage site. Well, this may produce some results in finding another transfer point or rarely a vector. A disciplined approach is much more effective. Mm-hmm. Listeria comes from several sources. It can be transferred from zone 4 outside the high-risk area. At that point, it's homeless or looking for a harborage location. Typically found with transfer point monitoring, it can come in on incoming product, although I think in our industry that's not such a critical thing, as we, you know, do have a pasteurization process called cooking. But for FDA regulated products and some of those that we deal with, that can be a real issue. Mm-hmm. Most significantly, though, it occurs in growth niches in a high-risk RTE area. That means that they are established, have found a protective home in the equipment or facility. They also may exist in a transient home, such as rework pans, trash containers, or other difficult-to-clean mobile container or the environment. So what we do is initiate investigation. The S&D mission is designed to identify the presence of harborage sites in the immediate area or pathways to that point. Want to sample all vectors coming to that positive site with the process running. We initiate aggressive sampling, such as daily post-initial rinse in the area along with indicator site sampling of sanitary facility design risk in that area. If all those fail, then we do a SWAT team sampling, which has picked up the term swab-a-thought. So those are really the summary of the methods. If we get in there and clean and sanitize and just sample that transfer point, we're sure not getting to the root cause.
Mm-hmm. What would you say over the course of your career was the most unexpected place where you found harborage in a plant?
Oh, that's a good question. We have found it in our slicers and slicer heads. We found it, in motors. We find it in condensing units. There's not too many places where you can't find it, in all honesty. Mm-hmm. It really depends. In my consulting business, we've been very successful in finding it in places that were very surprising because you thought the sanitation process was effective, but obviously it wasn't. So one of the keys here is the definition of a harborage site, and that is finding the organism after sanitation but before the operations begin. If you find a positive during operations, how do you know that site was a harborage site, not a transfer point? Mm. So sampling of facility risk areas includes sampling overheads, any standing water or seepage that are facility areas to investigate. Data analysis, mapping, and trending are tools that help isolate. We have to recognize the movement of transient equipment also. Mm-hmm. So once that harborage site's identified, the best practice then is to eliminate it by redesign. If that's not possible, then an intervention to eliminate the organism is the best option.
I want to ask further about, finding a niche in a motor, because I think most people on sanitation wouldn't be disassembling something like that. And obviously you need vents in motors because of the buildup of heat. So what's been a good intervention to use when is it replacing that part with something more cleanable or more something that's sealed, a sealed unit perhaps?
Yes. When you look at motors, there's many ways that a motor can be contaminated. Many of them have cooling fins on the outside, and then across the fins, nameplates applied that has the critical information about that perfect harborage site. Motors are often buried deep in equipment where you can't get at them. Likewise, I had a situation with a client where a motor was behind parts of the infrastructure and was inaccessible, and sanitation had to use a higher pressure to get the area as clean as they could. The last growth niche was a motor, and we had sampled it 3 or 4 times. Hadn't found it till we finally got the wherewithal to do a seek and destroy mission, took it apart, and there it was. Problem went away. But I fail to be surprised at this point.
Now, I have to ask you this, and I think the folks at the magazine knew that this one was coming, because I've often told your story that I heard you talk about a piece of equipment that couldn't be disassembled, and that your really innovative approach was to smoke it or put it in the smokehouse. And like I said, not only folks at the magazine have heard this countless times, but I use this in talking to food safety people because I just think it's tremendously innovative. So can you share that story with our listeners?
Yeah, you know, I certainly don't get credit for coming up with that intervention. Formex slide.
Well, I give you credit.
Well, I've been able to tell the story to a lot of folks and our industry. You know, it's very common in our industry to do this. In fact, I think it was about two or three workshops ago for the AMI or now NAMI, 90% of the participants in there were cooking equipment. But wow. Anyhow, it started with Formex slicers in the late 90s. Bruce Tompkin and Armour Swift Eckrich. He and his team developed that method because we knew that those slicers were not cleanable. After I attended one of those sessions, I go to our Searcy plant and talk to Steve Jones, who was our packaging maintenance leader, and I said, Steve, we're going to take one of those Merkel slicers and put it in the smokehouse and cook it. And Steve kind of looked at me and said, John, what kind of stuff have you been smoking? So yes, there is smoking involved in this, but anyhow, I was at the plant maybe 2 years later, and Steve pulls me aside and said, John, I got some data to share with you. He says, you know, cooking those slicers saves us money. Well, come on, Steve, wow. How's that? Well, he says, you know, sanitation's purpose in life is to put water in my motors. And he says, you know, when we designed that cooking cycle in the smokehouse, we added a dry cycle at the end. I haven't had to replace any of my motors ever since we did that, so it saves us money.
That's great.
So this is a classic example of how these best practices work in many different mm-hmm. ways. So what we've learned since then is to tint and steam. And a good example of that, Google Weber on YouTube on steaming a slicer. They've got a wonderful video on that really can show the audience how to really do that.
That's great. We'll make sure that we add that to the show notes for your episode.
Yeah.
Are there other kind of creative approaches that either you've developed or folks within the meat industry have developed to overcome some of the challenges that you all face?
Well, I think it's just a lot of common sense, and that common sense really gets down to simple ways of solving problems. And I think you can base a lot of those on the sanitary design principles that our AMI task teams, we had one on equipment and one on facilities, came up with. And, you know, first of all, we defined clean as clean to a microbiological level. And in my consulting practice today, I still find people don't recognize that that's how you measure clean. Mm-hmm. There's many others, such as compatible materials. Accessibility is critical. And this is where our suppliers are working very hard on getting equipment that's easily cleaned. We're looking at, in many cases, no tool disassembly. When we're doing seek and destroy investigations on old equipment, sometimes it takes a pretty long pipe to put on the end of a wrench to take things apart.
Right.
So those things don't really work as well as sanitary design does. So how you address that? Hollow rollers have always been critical, and we've learned the hard way on wet versus dry. Dry as I've stated earlier, is probably one of the keys that we have in process control. When you look at the facility, again, establishing those hygienic zones, that's why many smaller companies have a little more challenge, because it's hard to create those hygienic zones. And this is a particular issue in some of our fresh cut industries and vegetable processing and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So we want to control water and flow. You know, I think the system must facilitate sanitation. So those are some of the keys. So when we have a problem, and one of the things that I do when I do my research in reviewing 483s or other outbreak or recall situations, you can almost always point to one of these principles that or more that have been violated. So follow the principles and they will lead you to develop solutions. And I think the best solution, or the best way to get a solution, is using a multidisciplinary team. Food safety or quality can't do it alone. It takes that team and that team effort to do it. And, you know, brainstorming some of these solutions, you know, using a fishbone or things like that, it really works. You know, it's been critical in our system, is listening to the engineers and the maintenance folks. They understand things. So it's really just a lot of common sense.
I should note that we're going to have a link to NAMI's principles of the sanitary design and the checklist for folks to use, kind of an audit sheet and questions that they can assess their system. We'll post that in our show notes. I had a question about companies that don't feel that they have the capital resources to rebuild or redesign their equipment or to build a new facility. So how does a company know when they just need to bite the bullet with respect to that capital investment? Is it the fact that they have a growth niche that they can't get rid of? What do you think is that tipping point?
Well, typically it all evolves down to money.
Right.
If you have to spend more money and effort and energy managing a harborage site or a growth niche, then sometimes you're better off making that investment. The key here is every piece of equipment in the exposed product area needs an intervention process. Again, an intervention eliminates the organism from that piece of equipment. And it should be applied when the growth niche has bacterial growth. So, you know, many folks are doing this on a preventive basis, every week, every day, every month, something like that. But, you know, if you're still getting positives, you have to bear down and really spend money sampling and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the thing that we've learned over the years is that investment is critical. And we've had the fortunate of doing a greenfield, and I can assure you, sanitary design works. And it also, over the last, I'm going to say 15, 16 years, we are sampling more sites at Land of Frost, and it's costing less each year.
Wow.
So we're sampling more and spending less.
Now, how is that possible? Is it just because you're getting verification that your processes are doing what they're supposed to be doing?
No, not really. Yeah, we're getting verification. You know, the greenfield hasn't had a contact surface positive in 10 years. But, you know, It's how we design our sampling systems. And once you get control, and that means you're not doing two things.
Right.
You're not spending all that time investigating and money investigating, and you're not having product withdrawals or recalls or things like that. So, so you can, once you get under control, then you can also composite. And we do a lot of composite sampling. We do a lot of indicator site sampling, then that gives us more information about the movement or potential source or presence of the organism. And that really can get us into sampling methods.
That makes a lot of sense. Are you seeing new tools on the horizon available for the meat industry to use for environmental control?
Well, let's just say not only the meat industry, let's speak broadly of the food industry. I think to carry on the sampling comments, there's three fundamental types of sampling: verification, process control, and investigative. Verification is really what most establishments are doing. These are product samples. In USDA, those are zone one contact surface samples. And zone two and zone three sites, which are typically pathways and vectors. Verification sampling is during is conducted while the process is running. So, like I say, most of the sampling that most establishments are doing, they're going to classify as verification. Well, we've taken a harder look at that and developed what we call indicator sites. And these indicator sites give us a real measure of the process that we're trying to control. So indicator sites can be facility and equipment sanitary design risk or concerns. It can be zone four to zone three transfers. It can measure the effectiveness of hygienic zoning. And then our post-initial rinse is a very classic process control tool. Investigative really has two types. Investigative sampling is either going to be for cause or not for cause. The for cause happens when we have a verification site positive. That's when all hands on deck, and you know we go into firefighting
right.
mode. Not for cause is for purposes of process control. So, examples of the not for cause or process control investigations are samples taken to find a new growth niche, samples taken to find a transfer vector or pathway, samples taken to try to establish or qualify a hurdle or barrier system, to establish a new monitoring procedure or process, to assess a characteristic or risk of a control procedure, part of the facility or process change. They can be triggered by a zone 3 indicator or zone 4 indicator site positive. And these indicator sites are typically strategically located in close proximity to a known growth niche, barrier, or hurdle. We're looking to measure the movement of the organism from its source through the indicator site and ultimately then to a verification site, which is going to be located in a pathway of movement. Again, it's all about measuring the movement and preventing the movement of the organism. So, indicator sites then, if appropriately located with verification sites, are not measuring a food safety violation. So, that gives us a chance, and what I like to say, when we have a verification site positive, or an indicator site positive, plant manager should buy pizza. It's cause for celebration. So that's some of the not for cause thing. So, you know, doing the seek and destroy investigation on a piece of equipment repeatedly then enables you to evaluate your sanitation methods and identify potential areas of risk. And it certainly helps you identify the most critical sanitation process controls thing, and that's a degree of disassembly for complex equipment. So there's many things that we can do with not-for-cause investigations to help us develop those process control issues. And I think one of the keys here is to recognize the linking or the linkage of sanitary design to our sampling program. This is where indicator sites can really prove to be early warning predictors of process control issues.
Now, how often do you recommend that a not-for-cause investigation be conducted?
Well, I like to see as many indicator sites as you have verification sites, maybe more. And that's a real challenge to do that. But, you know, in all honesty, I think the indicator sites, once you understand the relevance of an indicator site to a verification site, they really become your process control indicators. So I think it's very important to continuously challenge yourself to come up with more of these indicator sites. It really helps the investigators, the team, the establishment to understand movement and where the organism's coming from. Helps them understand how to manage risk.
Right. Now, John, you've referenced your consulting group a couple times. Your logo for Food Safety by Design has the words awareness, enlightenment, preventive, predictive. What made you choose these words, and can you explain what you mean by that for your business?
You know, during the teaching of the AMI Listeria workshop and our experiences as a manufacturer providing ingredients to not only other processors, but also to the fast food and HRI industries. We received a lot of feedback and observations and became curious to try to classify some of those observations. Many of our customers, and they still do, want sample the product. You know, I want to know it's okay. Well, they're aware then that there's an issue, but unfortunately, they're not enlightened as to what the real problem is. Well, there's also one before awareness, and that's called doubt. And I don't include that because that's bars and stripes. So awareness, the company has become aware of the problem, and they just continue to get more positives if they're testing, or they're not really testing to find it. They become enlightened when, wow, they found a harborage site. They now recognize the root cause. What do they do about it? Well, they become preventive once they know how to apply an intervention to the harborage site, such as cooking the piece of equipment, using a COP tank for an intervention, disassembly and high concentration sanitization followed by a contact concentration of sanitizer. So, you know, that intervention then becomes the separating point between firefighting and not firefighting and celebration. Right. You know, if I have an indicator site, we buy pizza. You know, that's a win-win. So it really becomes then a cultural maturity model. And we go from preventive to predictive once we learn how to use the data that we gather from our sampling, and particularly the indicator site sampling, verification sampling. You know, at the predictive state, we're not managing listeria anymore. We're managing growth niches.
Right.
So that's really where it came about. And my goal is to help companies get in that preventive and predictive state.
Great. So, John, as we wrap up today with your benefit of your career in the food industry, what are some of the major challenges that remain, and how close are we to really, addressing some of those outstanding issues?
Well, I think the FDA-regulated processes are now going through what we experienced in the late 90s and early 2000s. And we know the best practices. It's just getting those applied. And I think that there's a number of groups now that have taken on that challenge. I know the dairy industry has done a great job with their educational efforts and understanding sanitary design of things that need to be disassembled. We've got United Fresh and Produce Marketing Association. We started workshops with them, and they're now in, I think, their second year of doing this, and they're really starting to expand that scope. So those types of education need to get to all the manufacturers. And also critical to that is the leaders of the organization and the industries need to recognize that there's things they have to do. They can't be in that doubtful stage. They can't remain just aware and not doing anything about it. I'll let Sean talk about that stuff. So the real challenge beyond that then really is in the smaller delis and commissaries. Facility design's a real challenge for those. And equipment design, the equipment's not out there that's easily cleaned and made for sanitary design. And there's a lot of small workforces scattered throughout. I mean, think of the challenge that a large retail establishment has and the turnover they're faced with their deli workers. So I think those are some of our bigger challenges. And I really think we know the best practices. We understand sanitary design. It's now down to culture.
Right. Your comments bring to mind one item that I always find to be a huge challenge, and that is in the small deli, the single owner, how do you educate those folks? They're not going to the different meetings that you and I attend. They're, that's a challenge that I see that, the industry needs to maybe do a better job in trying to reach out to the smaller players in the space as well.
Yeah, it's that's always the classic. And then, going one step further, how do we educate at the household level? Eventually,
right.
If you've got a compromised person that you're taking care of, an old person like me, you got to do special things. So education is always a challenge.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of things that we're learning how to do. The internet is certainly one of those, I think, that can help. There's just more and more and more information like this available. So it takes a desire on those to seek that out. It is there. It's just
right.
Just getting them to do it. And again, that's where I think culture plays a key role.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, John, for being our guest today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara.
So here's something we haven't had to do before, but for the sake of accuracy, we have an editor's note. During the interview, Barbara stated that there had not been an illness or fatality due to listeria in a meat product since around 2003. Since we recorded the interview, sadly, this is no longer the case. CDC reported on October 3rd that there have been 4 illnesses and 1 death due to an outbreak of Listeria monocytogenes. Epidemiologic laboratory and traceback evidence indicates that ham products from Johnston County hams are the likely source of the outbreak. Thanks again to John Butts for taking the time to join us today, and thank you for listening. Thanks again to our presenting sponsor, Eurofins. To learn more about their industry-leading environmental monitoring program, visit eurofins.us/EMP. As always, we've got links to all the resources that we've mentioned in the episode in our show notes, and you can access those in your podcast player or on our website at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast and then find episode 35. We want to send out special thanks to everyone who has taken the time to rate and review the podcast. If you haven't already, throw some stars our way. It really helps people find the podcast. And for those of you who haven't, it's time you subscribe to Food Safety Matters. One click, that's right, one click, make sure that you get all the new and bonus episodes of the podcast. And Adam shared with me this morning that you can ask Siri to subscribe to the podcast. Just tell Siri, subscribe to the Food Safety Matters podcast. She, of course, told Adam that he was already subscribed. But it was fun. And this will surely work with our friends Alexa and the Google Assistant as well. So it's fun. We're all getting used to AI. All right. And you know we love your feedback. So please send us an email at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or drop us a note on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. That's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on October 23rd. We'll talk to you then.